Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged each week to be blessed by the intelligence of a man with great acumen about what is going on in Asia and what it means for all of us. He is, of course, Gordon Chang. You find him starring at places like Fox News, but also writing with great effect at The Daily Beast and Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, and elsewhere. We're always delighted to have him here, among other things, to talk about some of the insights that you can find in his best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
No, thank you so much, Frank.
As we speak, President Trump is at the United Nations for a couple of days of diplomatic statecraft and derring do. Prominently featured in much of his conversations there, apparently, will be North Korea, which, since we last talked, has again sent a missile over the Japanese home islands, again signaling its indifference to UN sanctions, which it has again been subjected to. So give us an update, Gordon, on what has been developing in all of these areas and the implications, if any, of the General Assembly's meetings and conversations on their margins.
In anticipation of the UN General Assembly meeting, there were a number of administration officials on the talk show circuit this week. So, for instance, we had H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, tell us that we're really out of time on diplomacy, and he's very specific on that. Also, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, very much the same theme. And I think what the administration is trying to do is put pressure on the Chinas and Russias of the world to say that if they don't come on board and actually help us with these sanctions, that there will be military action on the part of the United States. I don't know if Moscow and Beijing believe them, but nonetheless, that's what the administration appears to be doing.
And McMaster, among other things, said very explicitly that there are military options. Do you see evidence of that?
When we talk about military options, everyone thinks about surgical strikes or more massive strikes on North Korea. But there's one military option we don't talk about, and that is something that I think we should actually do, and that is to board and inspect North Korean ships on their ways to, for instance, Iran. We know that the North Koreans get somewhere between $2 and $3 billion a year from the Iranians, much of it for missiles, also nuclear weapons technology. In the last set of UN sanctions, Resolution 2375, the United States did not get what it wanted, which was a right to board ships without the consent of the ship owners. Nonetheless, I think that we've got to do this to stop this weapons trade, but also we have the authority to do this. And paradoxically enough, the North Koreans have given us this authority, because at least three times last decade, they abrogated the Korean War armistice, which means if there's no agreement not to use force, we can sink those ships. If we can sink them, we can certainly board them. And so I believe that we can actually go ahead and do this. So I hope that the administration takes a more robust view. We take the view that the armistice still is in existence, but as a legal matter, Frank, that is untenable because one party to an agreement not to use force says it's no longer bound. Therefore, we should take the North Koreans at their word and start being a bit more coercive.
I couldn't agree more, Gordon. And one of the things that Jim Woolsey has been suggesting, as have others, is that these North Korean satellites over our country, at least with some regularity, could well be devices capable of unleashing an electromagnetic pulse attack against us. As long as we're boarding ships, it seems to me neutralizing those satellites ought to be a pretty high priority as well. You've written a piece at Forbes.com about India and Japan encircling China. One of the things I've been struck by is as these missiles are being launched now, two of them, I guess, over the Japanese home islands by the North Koreans, the trajectory those missiles are following would be pretty much what an attack on Japan might look like as well. Shouldn't the Japanese, and with our help as needed, be preventing those missiles from doing that?
The trajectories of those missiles make it clear that they're not going to hit the Japanese homeland, but nonetheless, these are extremely provocative. And the one thing that we have seen recently is that Kim Jong-un is becoming even more provocative in his actions, which means he's not being deterred by whatever we say or whatever we do. We need to take the initiative away from Kim, and one of the ways to do that is the next time that he decides to arc a missile over Japan is actually to take it down. We got to remember that ballistic missile tests are prohibited by the Security Council, but the Security Council has not talked about how to enforce this particular prohibition. We need to go about this. And Frank, if we want to remember about the consequences of this, all we have to do is think back to last decade about the dozen or so Security Council resolutions on Iraq, the Security Council refusing to provide any mechanism in terms of enforcement of them, and ending up with the Iraq War. So this is a critical issue that we faced last decade. It's an issue that we face now.
And it requires the cooperation of the Russians and the Chinese if there is to be a UN Security Council enforcement mechanism put into place. I must tell you, I'm not going to hold my breath on that, Gordon. But do talk about this idea of a sort of geostrategic arrangement that may be not only causing China concerns, but also an important counterweight to some of the things they're doing that are of concern to us, namely with the Japanese and the Indians, among others.
Shinzo Abe, the Japanese prime minister, was in India for 2 days. And what the prime minister was doing was announcing Japanese infrastructure projects in the northeastern part of that country. The reason why that's important is because the Chinese are threatening India's northeast. And so Japan was showing solidarity with Narendra Modi, his Indian counterpart. This is, I think, important because you have two extremely important countries banding together. They're both American friends. One of them is, in fact, an American treaty ally, Japan. And I think that a union of the world's most populous democracy, India, and its most powerful one, that's, of course, us, is an unbeatable combination, especially when we have the help of our friends like Japan. So I think China is really, you know, people say, oh, China's the owner of the 21st century. You know, there's not too much we can do about this. Well, that's not right, because we have countries that are extremely concerned about China. And indeed, Japan and India have much more effective China policies than we do. We have a lot of learning. We should go to school in Tokyo and in New Delhi about how to deal with the Chinese, because we're well behind the curve on that one, Frank.
We are indeed. Well, we find ourselves going to school with you each week, Gordon Chang. I'm very grateful for that. Let me ask you very quickly, Gordon. Gasoline prices are spiking in this country, in part because of these, hurricanes, of course, and the effect that they're having on refineries. The Chinese are in our energy sector, as well as, of course, the Saudis and Russians. Is that something we should be concerned about, Gordon, as we're looking at the possible interference from those quarters?
We don't want the Chinese in our economy at all, except if they're happy to buy real estate, apartments in New York. That's not a national security issue. But nonetheless, China involved in any other part of our economy is. The one thing that we can just sort of take a little bit of comfort in is that no country has ever cornered a commodity. And the Chinese are not going to be the first if they're going after oil or natural gas. But nonetheless, we need to have a thorough review, not just of individual Chinese acquisitions like Lattice Semiconductor, but really a review of the entire process where we look at Chinese investments into the United States. This Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., CFIUS, we need to turn it around in terms of China, where the presumption is not that an acquisition is permitted, but if it's a Chinese acquirer, that the acquisition is not permitted. And that's across all sectors, including energy, in my view.
What a bracing idea. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time. I would say that the Chinese have done a pretty good job of cornering the rare earth minerals commodity market, but that may be the exception that proves the rule otherwise. Gordon, thanks so much for your time. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will stick around when we talk with Frank Calzone about the latest attacks against American diplomatic personnel in Cuba and what we're going to do about it. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by the executive director of a very important freedom-fighting organization, the Center for a Free Cuba. He is Frank Calzone. He has been active as a man born in Cuba before it became enslaved and active ever since coming to our country and trying to free Cuba. Then he's just told me, begun working with the president of the Center for a Free Cuba, James Kaysen, who as a career foreign service officer served, among other places, in the interest section in Havana, a perfect source for insights into one of the topics we wanted to discuss with Frank Calzone, namely attacks on our diplomatic personnel now serving at Embassy Havana. Frank Calzone, welcome back. It's good to talk with you, though I'm sorry to say it's about a subject that's pretty grim. Tell us what we know about it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. What we do know about it is that it is a fact that American diplomats have been hurt by something in Havana. Those folks who claim that the Cuban government has little or nothing to do about it apparently do not understand what the Cuban government is all about. Nothing that could happen to an American diplomat in Cuba could not be known to the Cuban authorities. They monitor, they keep track of every American diplomat 24 hours a day.
Is it your sense, then, that they would be actually responsible for what's happened, Frank? Or does that simply mean that they would be knowledgeable about somebody else doing it to our diplomats?
Well, first of all, they are legally responsible because they are the host country and they should protect American diplomats there. Imagine what the scandal would be if there were Cuban diplomats in Washington that all of a sudden we're all getting sick in such a fashion. Well, what we know is what has appeared in the public record. According to the State Department, and we know that there are many folks in the State Department that the last thing they would like to see is a material that is negative on U.S.-Cuban relations to be known by the American people. But in any case, we know that quite a few were brought out of Cuba for medical care in the United States. Many are deaf. They have their reports of what they call mild brain damage. And so that is a fact. Now, Raul Castro is trying to say that, no, he didn't know anything about it. They claim that they're looking for it. Someone should ask General Raul Castro if he also didn't know anything about shipping warplanes to North Korea, or if he doesn't know that there are American terrorists under his protection in Cuba. So I mean, this is to believe as Fulton Armstrong, a former CIA person. Is saying now, well, we don't know who is responsible. If you believe that, you might as well believe in Santa Claus and the fairy tale.
Yeah, the tooth fairy. So, Frank, we are told by some estimates 21 of our diplomatic personnel have been subjected to some kind of damaging sonic or other signatures or impulses that are causing, as you say, hearing loss and impairment of some of their other faculties and also some brain injuries. Is it your judgment, as far as you can tell, that the Cuban government itself would be not only aware of what's going on here, but and responsible for it, needless to say, but also complicit in it? Or is there reason to believe that perhaps the Russians or the Chinese may be helping their Cuban friends by impairing our personnel in this fashion?
I'm not really sure that the Russians or the Chinese want to do something like that in Cuba. But I am sure that as President Trump came to the White House, the Cuban government, as it has done throughout history, tried to do things to see how far they could push Washington. This might very well be one of those efforts to test the administration. I was glad to learn late yesterday that the Secretary of State has been quoted saying that they have under consideration, the administration has under consideration closing the embassy. Frankly, if one asks what is gained by keeping the embassy open for American interests, I don't see that much has been gained for the United States.
Yeah. Well, not only has there not been much gain from it, but actually we have put Americans at risk by having them associated with it. It seems eminently sensible, both for policy as well as humanitarian reasons, that we would stop doing that to our personnel. And you mentioned earlier that lots of people in the State Department wouldn't want any harm to come to U.S.-Cuban relations, but I'm pretty sure they wouldn't want any harm to come to our Foreign Service officers either. So this seems like an eminently sensible approach.
At the very least, while they find out what's happening, they should have brought out all American diplomats from Cuba and the Cuban government. Until we get to the bottom of these, the embassy is not functioning anymore.
Yeah. It seems sensible. Let me ask you finally, Frank Calzone of the Center for a Free Cuba. Cuba was, of course, pretty badly hit by Hurricane Irma, as have been, of course, many parts of the United States as well. There's some concern about trying to do what we reflexively do in this country, which is to try to provide humanitarian relief to those who've been harmed in these ways, as long as this would involve, in effect, providing such relief through the Cuban government. Give us your thoughts on how best to do that if we are going to try to help the Cuban people.
Well, of course, the Cuban people need a lot of help. The problem is that if you see those buildings collapsing in Havana now because of a hurricane, most of the media has not reported those buildings have been collapsing for a long time. Whenever there is heavy rains in Havana, buildings collapse. So this is not a new thing. Secondly, if the administration were to provide help to Cuba and give it to the Cuban government, that would not go to the Cuban people. That would be sold in the hard currency stores. So the most needy would not get it, that it would go to the military and that kind of thing. If anybody is seriously thinking about sending humanitarian assistance to Cuba, it should be one major condition, that Americans, maybe the American Red Cross, maybe the National Guard, but some Americans should be distributing the assistance, and the assistance should be clearly labeled coming from the United States. Otherwise, the Cuban government might tell the Cuban people that the assistance is coming from elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah. As well as making off with it, as you say, Frank Calzone. Such cynicism is certainly well-founded in past experience, and the last thing we want to do is prop up the government of Fidel and now Raul Castro. Frank Calzone, thanks for all you do to try to undermine that horrible regime in Cuba and promote freedom in our hemisphere. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Brad Owens. He's one of the contractors that Hillary Clinton's State Department sought to silence about Benghazi. That and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by Brad Owens, a man who served for some 25 years as an Army special operator, a paratrooper with an intelligence background, in combat in Iraqi freedom, and subsequently, after taking off his uniform, as a contractor providing diplomatic security for our personnel in some of the world's most dangerous places. He was a candidate for doing so in Benghazi, but found himself at the losing end of a competition with a low bidder called Blue Mountain Group. And as a result, his company, Torres Advanced Enterprise Solutions, was excluded. Had that not gone as it did, perhaps we might not have had the incident that killed four Americans and embroiled our country for years in the aftermath of a terrorist attack in Benghazi. It's good to have a chance to review what happened there and how with Brad Owens. Brad, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Good to have you with us.
Mr. Yaffe, thank you for having me this morning.
Let me ask you first to talk a little bit about your group, Torres Advanced Enterprise Solutions. Why is it that your company wasn't providing security at some very exposed facilities in Benghazi 5 years ago?
Well, the main reason is because the bid process kind of ties the hands a little bit. The way these contracts are bid, there's a 1990 law. For folks who don't know, I mean, you know, a lot of people think Marines guard embassies and consuls and those sort of things, but that's not true. They're not there to guard the people. They're there to guard the classified information, the crypto, that sort of thing. That was a secondary role. So the outer defense of it, the TSA, I guess, the guys who run the magnetic detectors and the X-ray machine, is what's called local guard force. And it's local nationals hired by a contracting firm like ours who trains them and manages them. So we bid on these contracts. We have about 6,000 employees worldwide. We have a lot of these embassies and we have a lot of high threat area contracts around. We bid on this contract. It came out in February of 2012.
At a time, we should add, when there was a lot of concern on the part of Chris Stevens, then the ambassador in Libya, about the dangers that were confronting their personnel, our American personnel, in these exposed facilities. Is that right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you don't have to even think about it. Just go read his own words. There's a lot of WikiLeaks cables that were, you know, classified cables that got released related to it. The regional security officer, which was Eric Nordstrom, who worked at the embassy there, and the ambassador's entire team made over 400 requests from the year leading up to the Benghazi attacks for additional security, additional resources on the ground. So you tell me, okay, they knew. The guys on the ground are not to blame for this. They knew what the situation was, the security situation. After Gaddafi was killed, the security situation. I was there on the ground during this time period as well. I was actually in Libya. The security situation began to deteriorate quickly because the Katibas, which were militias, began fighting each other for power, attacking each other's ministers, and even attacking Western missions. So actually, by the time the Benghazi attacks happened in 2012, September 2012, the Brits had already pulled out.
And is it fair to say, so our audience is clear about this, that the reason that those myriad pleas for help were being ignored was it conflicted with the party line in Washington that this whole liberation of Libya, as they called it, was going swimmingly?
Well, and I don't have any firsthand knowledge because I wasn't invited in the policymaking side of things. But I can tell you that it doesn't take a genius to read the cables that were coming back from Libya. And the post-conflict was a failure. Now, I can say this. You know, we worked with a lot of these Katibas in and around Libya, you know, right at from the second half of the war. And they wanted our support, and they weren't going to get it. I mean, as a matter of fact, they wanted us to come in and retrain their new army and some things, say the United States, but there was what was called the soft power approach. They didn't want to seem like, you know, aggressors. You know, I don't know the policy level, but I can tell you this. Anyone who has any experience in these things should know that post-conflict zones are not easy. They're a sticky mess. So unless you dedicate serious resources to it, it falls apart, which is what did. And so I can say this, that obviously this is kind of like the sky's blue and water's wet. We didn't put enough resources in there to help stabilize the country after we helped create the chaos.
And the Blue Mountain Group, which was the low bidder on this contract, was clearly incapable of performing the mission, especially under ground rules that I understand involve, for example, not having that outer ring of defense armed. Is that right?
This was a kind of an interesting unwritten policy. In the past administration, they had took what's called a soft power approach. And what they wanted to do was present a less aggressive image around the world at our embassy. So they began, this contract was a one-year contract, but usually they're for 5 years at a full embassy. And as those bids come up every 5 years, they started disarming them around the world. Where they were armed, they would take the armed contingent piece out of it. They even came to our company, you know, in Panama and Peru and asked us to voluntarily disarm them, which we, of course, refused. We believe all of these should be armed. And it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of security at these missions, because we are not diplomats. I am not a diplomat. I am a security professional. My job is to prevent bad actors who want to do bad things to our good people, to put an obstacle between them so they don't have the opportunity.
Very quickly, let's just cut to the chase here. You were not given the contract, and then as I understand it, 2 weeks out from what proved to be the fatal attack against Chris Stevens and three others at that facility in Benghazi, you were importuned by the State Department to come in and try to tighten things up. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And what happened was Jan Vicentainer, who's one of the contracting officers we named in the story, Jan Vicentainer, Sharon James, she pulled our director of operations. We had won the Pakistan embassy contract. They were in meetings to stand it up. She pulled him out and said, hey, can you guys perform in Libya? So we, of course, said yes. They called, you know, the director of operations called me and I started getting the team activated. Now, we can be anywhere in the world in 48 hours on a green light. So we were getting the team ready to stand up, and so our director of operations was calling her every day after that, going, are we ready to go? Should we go? Are we ready to go? And they kept stalling us. And unfortunately, 12 days later, they were killed, and then we didn't hear anything else about it. Now, fast forward about a few months, Jerry Torres, who's the owner of Torres, got a call to come back from overseas to State Department to meet with these guys, Vicentainer and James and some other folks. He goes back to the State Department, flies back, meets him. It was a weird meeting. Nothing of substance was discussed. But on the way out, Jan Vicentainer pulls him aside and says, hey, Jerry, we really need you to be in lockstep with us on this Benghazi thing. Now, they hadn't discussed Benghazi in the meeting, so he kind of was kind of curious. And she said, yeah, she said, don't speak to the press about it. Don't cooperate with anyone looking into it, you know. And then came a very not so veiled threat. She said, look, you guys have been, you know, we need you to be in a team player on this because, you know, look, you guys have been winning a lot of contracts with us around the world and, you know, you're doing a lot of good work and we'd like to keep it that way. And then she followed up with, and if you have to talk, you have to, you know, let them know that you agree with us that it should have been unarmed. He called me immediately and relayed this conversation because that was my area. I was the African operations director at the time. You know, and I advised him to file an IG complaint, but we decided to stand down because the congressional investigations and everything were just getting started. And so we figured something would come out of that that got justice. But also, these State Department folks have the capability and will retaliate against you if you file complaints against them.
Just very quickly, we're almost out of time, but I would ask you, Brad Owens, takeaway from this, for me at least, is you don't want low bidders necessarily getting these very important contracts unless you want more Benghazis. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a point to be made here that no one was held accountable. Not one single person in the state was fired over these mistakes, and the contracting piece of it, which contributed greatly. But I would encourage your listeners, if you want to see some changes, there's a 1990 law which ties the hands of everybody involved. It requires that they go with the lowest bid that's technically acceptable, which means the very minimum technical experience and capability to do the very minimum job with the low bid. And so what we'd like to see is the law change, because the law had a temporary suspension because of this, but there's been nothing done that permanently changes it. So I would put on the table right now that it could happen again, because the same people are at State Department making the decisions and the laws haven't been changed.
Amazingly, one thought that there was a new administration, but it turns out it's pretty much the same folks. Brad Owens, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time and for your efforts to prevent debacles like Benghazi, both in the past and in the future. Keep up the good work, my friend, at Torres Advanced Enterprise Solutions, and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Dan Perkins joins us. He's an author, a pundit, and a defender of freedom and the people who provide our safety. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us once again a man I've come to admire greatly in the course of our numerous conversations on this program. He is Dan Perkins. He is a veteran, he is an author, he is a money manager, and he is a man working to help save the lives of American servicemen and women who have been harmed in the course of their service to our country. We're delighted to have a chance to showcase all of that with him. Thank you so much, Dan, for joining us once again, the author, most recently, of The Brotherhood of the Red Nile. Thanks for joining us, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on again.
We'd like to talk about several things with you. First and foremost, you have been doing some, I would say, path-breaking thinking about how we must contend with a threat from North Korea before we lose American lives. Talk about a recommendation you made some 7 weeks ago, and also about sort of what it seems is now a growing sense that you were absolutely right. It is what's needed.
I have obviously studied, because of my trilogy on radical Islamic nuclear terrorism, I've had an opportunity to spend a huge amount of time researching terrorism and nuclear weapons. And so it came to me that at the time, nobody was talking about what might be a least costly in terms of human life on either side of a way to bring this North Korean situation to an end. And about 7 weeks ago, I wrote a piece for LifeZet that talked about the solution to the conflict with North Korea is an embargo, much like what we did in Cuba. We basically patrolled the island and nothing got in and nothing got out. And eventually what happened is the Russians backed down. They agreed to take away their missiles and the embargo ended.
This is, of course, to some extent, dependent on a problem that we've had all along. And that is that two of North Korea's terrestrial, or I should say neighbors who can get access to their country over land, are not cooperating. What would you expect would be, set aside for the moment, how the North Koreans might respond to a blockade? What would the Chinese and Russians do about trying to cut them off at this point?
I would respectfully somewhat disagree with your observation, because at the most recent Security Council vote on even stiffer sanctions against North Korea, Russia and China made it unanimous. And I think that there's a problem that Kim is creating for him in his relationship with China, because the last hydrogen bomb test put radioactive fallout in China. And I think the Chinese are now concerned that if he's going to test bigger and better bombs, the possibility of radioactive fallout on the Chinese people is something they have to be very concerned about.
Yeah. And I think they voted for these resolutions in the past, if I'm not mistaken, Dan. It's just that they haven't really enforced them. So, but maybe you're right that this is a moment when they will start to do so. And if so, then a lot of other things become possible. I think that's for sure. But talk about Nikki Haley and something she said at the United Nations recently that seems to suggest people are picking up on your idea of a blockade.
She suggested that they needed to do a blockade of North Korea. Now, I want to talk about that, but just let me give you one fact that's happened since Labor Day. Under the UN sanctions, there has been a limitation on the amount of crude oil that can be sent into North Korea, about half of what was there. Between the period of time of Labor Day weekend and last Friday, the price of a gallon of gasoline in North Korea is now $10. A gallon of fuel oil or diesel fuel is $8. Gasoline is up 47%. Fuel oil is up 60% in cost. Less supply, and it's the basic economic principles. Lower supply, against higher demand, prices rise. So the ability of the economy to withstand just that one piece, or the individual households that may have a car or a truck or whatever, or a business, it's going to have a tremendous impact on them. I think that the Chinese and the Russians are getting a little fed up with Mr. Kim and his ranting. We don't have a perspective. It's important for people, your listeners, to understand. The country of North Korea is about the size of the state of New Jersey. This is not a world massive country. Their total exports, 93% of all their exports go to China. 1 year's worth of exports from South Korea to China are worth 38 hours of exports from China to the United States. So the power that we have is the ability to influence the amount of trade that comes from China to the United States.
This is clearly where we were with Gordon Chang earlier in the program. It does considerable measure depend on the Chinese. And I think you're right. If in fact they're now getting a taste of what this nuclear menace represents in North Korea to their own people, it may improve rather dramatically their willingness to play a constructive role instead of undermining constructive roles. Let me ask you about another issue. You have been helping veterans who have been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and other wounds of war through a program that you call Songs and Stories for Soldiers. You can find out more about this wonderful program at songsandstoriesforsoldiers.us, folks. This comes to mind because I was listening earlier in the day to reports that there are servicemen and women from the Vietnam era who are now experiencing spikes in suicidal tendencies as a result of, apparently, the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam now sort of reopening old wounds. Would you talk a little bit about what your program does and whether this is something that should be of great concern to all of us? We may see this long-suffering generation of veterans afflicted all over again.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I've already been getting phone calls from veterans that I've worked with across the country who are suffering from PTSD and sleep deprivation, which is an extension of PTSD, and then the ultimate extension is suicide. There seem to be outrage because the initial episode is a replay of what they went through when the country abandoned them, and we had people like Jane Fonda and other people protesting the war, trying to get soldiers to desert. The way they were treated, we spend a lot of time with an organization called the Vet Centers. These are for combat veterans only, and they were created at the 5 years after the end of the war, through the demands of veterans who felt that they were being discriminated against at the VA hospitals and were treated as if they were the problem, and much like the way we treated them when they came home as a general society. And so the vet centers were created to create a place where combat veterans could go and talk and deal with issues. And we work with those centers all across the country. And we still have the largest influx of veterans in all VA facilities across the United States are Vietnam era veterans. I work with the Disabled Veterans of America here in Cape Coral. That's their biggest issue, is dealing with veterans who are still suffering from PTSD. Think about that. This is going to continue for 18 episodes.
It is perhaps a profound disservice to the country to be doing this, certainly at least to our veterans, and we will be talking more about it, I hope, with you in the near future. Dan Perkins, thank you so much for your super contributions to our literature, notably with The Brotherhood of the Red Nile and the rest of your trilogy. We look forward to the new book coming out in October and appreciate the work that you're doing, of course, with Songs and Stories for Soldiers. Keep it up to us, sir. Come back soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.